You are now listening to Jess's Lit on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Jess's Lit. We are back with another episode of the Shakespeare series, sonnet series. Last episode, I kind of left off just by reading sonnet 115. Can you believe it, guys? We have already hit over 110. You know, I was expecting this to be a lot longer and more, I guess, daring than how it kind of came off to be in real life, actually, in reality. And so I've been getting a lot of good feedbacks and good contributions with you guys with this series. And so I'm super happy. And we're almost done, but we are just getting started with 115 today. I'll give you guys a read of 115 and we'll kind of just start off with that. But before we do so, I have one song to play for you guys and some ads and show promos and PSAs. And so after that, we will get right into it. The first song to play today is called Purple Haze by Jimi Hendrix. And so we'll be right back after those.
Picture this, you're walking into your local record store and start skimming the many records until you find an album that you recognize. You pick out the album, check the track list, and maybe only recognize a couple songs. Now you have to listen to the whole album, right? Well, why not do it together? On Discali, every show runs you through an entire album and breaks down key parts and songs that make up an album's aesthetic, art, and story. I'm your host, Oliver, and join me every Friday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. in talking about all things music. Want to discover more albums, artists, record pressings, and concerts? I got you. That's every Friday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m., so tune in to Discali to discover different discographies and add to the musical discourse.
If the news are getting you down or you're tired of scrolling on your phone, Massey Books is the one-stop shop for you. A 100% Indigenous-owned business that is committed to giving back to local charities, community initiatives, and organizations, Massey Books has a vast selection of rare and unique books, as well as a diverse range of books that are from underrepresented authors. You can shop online at masseybooks.com or visit their store on 229 East Georgia Street in Chinatown. They are open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Wednesday to Saturday, and 12 to 5 from Sunday to Tuesday. Their friendly staff would love to give you a hand to find your new favorite read. Are you looking to decolonize your self-care routine? Take a trip down to Sisters Sage for a variety of handmade soaps, bath fizzies, smudge sprays, and salves infused with traditional plant medicines. Sisters Sage is an award-winning local Indigenous business run by Tsimshian and entrepreneur, activist, and community builder Lynn Marie Angus and her dog TJ. Passionate about crafting wellness products that are respectful of the land we live on, Sisters Sage is committed to a heart-centered approach to self-care as well as our collective healing. Located on 1312 Kingsway, you can drop by from Monday to Saturday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. See you there.
What a beautiful day.
Yeah.
Are you hungry? I think I'm hungry. I think we should get ourselves something nice for our beach day.
Oh, yeah?
Oh my god, I know the perfect place. Cockney King's Fish and Chips is literally just around the corner. We should go there. It is the best fish and chips in Vancouver.
Oh my god, yes, absolutely. Let's go right now.
Cockney King's Fish and Chips, Kitsilano. On Cornwall Avenue, between Cypress and Walnut. It's the best fish and chips in town, but don't take our word for it. Try it yourself. If Kitsilano isn't your neighborhood, check out Cockney King's in Burnaby or New Westminster.
Are you interested in radio? Do you want to start your own show, but you don't know where to get started? Make your radio dreams come true by joining a collective. From the news collective, the arts collective, the music collective, the sports collective, the accessibility collective, the Indigenous collective, and the intersectionality collective, there's something for everyone. And we provide free technical training to get started. Explore these worlds virtually and in person, and be prepared to make fun friends. For more information, visit citr.ca/get involved.
You just finished listening to Jimi Hendrix's Purple Haze, some ads, show promos, and PSAs. Let's get right into Sonnet 115. Those lines that I before have writ do lie, even those that said I could not love you dearer, yet than my judgment knew no reason why, my most full flame should afterwards burn clearer. But reckoning time, whose millioned accidents creep in twixt vows and change decrees of kings, tan sacred beauty, blunt the sharpest intents, divert strong minds to the course of altering things. At last, alas, why fearing of time's tyranny, might I not then say now I love you best, when I was certain over uncertainty, crowning the present doubting of the rest. Love is a babe, then might I not say so, to give full growth to that which still doth grow. Now here the poet acknowledges that the very fact that his love has grown makes his earlier poems about the fullness and constancy of his love into lies. With lines 1 and 2, the speaker begins with a bold confession that his prior poetic statements were false. Even those that proclaimed an absolute unsurpassable love, seen in the phrase, I could not love you dearer, are now proven untrue, not because the love has lessened, but because it has grown beyond what he then thought was its limit. There's a self-aware irony here also, where language, fixed and finite, cannot capture the involving intensity of love. And so we could also see it as the poet disowning his own previous language. With lines 3 to 4, at that time, the speaker had no rational explanation or expectation that his love could grow any stronger. His flame felt, quote-unquote, most full at its peak. But time has proven otherwise, and the phrase burn clearer suggests both increased intensity and purity, a refining of emotion that comes with experience and endurance. With lines 5 and 8, here time is personified as a destabilizing, almost sinister force. Its quote-unquote million accidents, which is the countless unforeseeable events it brings, sneak between even the most sacred commitments, which kind of undermine the authority and fade beauty, dull ambition, and ultimately distract or redirect even the strongest wills. And so we could see that Shakespeare here invokes time's corrosive power and emphasizes how it erodes constancy, which also includes love. Lines 9 to 12. In hindsight, the speaker questions why he didn't seize the moment and proclaim his love at its then peak, fearing how time might alter or diminish it. He was certain, quote-unquote, certain over uncertainty, which is paradoxical, and it means that despite life's unpredictability, he felt sure in that moment. He, quote-unquote, crowned the present, which is an image of regal elevation of the now, while suspecting the future would only bring doubt. And so these lines capture the human impulse to fix feelings in time and to make them absolute before they ultimately change. The final couplet is very powerful, and it invokes an image of love being a child. And so love's a child that still grows and is still developing. And even declarations of fullest love are premature. And by acknowledging love as an evolving force, seen in the quote, that which still doth grow, the speaker justifies his earlier quote-unquote lie. It wasn't a lie in feeling, just in its attempt to limit or complete something that is, by nature, in progress. And so that was an analysis of Sonnet 115. We'll move on to Sonnet 116. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love, which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover or remove. Oh no, it is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark, whose worth's unknown, although his height be taken. Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom. If this be error and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved. Now Sonnet 116. Here the poet meditates on what he sees as the truest and strongest kind of love, that between minds. He defines such union as unalterable and eternal. And so with lines 1 and 2, the opening line invokes a ceremonial tone, which in a sense echoes the marriage rites of the Anglican Church. And we can see that in the phrase, if any of you know cause or just impediment. The speaker refuses to allow any impediment to the union of quote-unquote true minds, not bodies notably, but minds. This signals that true love is spiritual and intellectual and not just merely physical. The phrase marriage of true minds is also significant as it invokes a platonic ideal, of a two souls in harmonious accord. The second line is also cool because Shakespeare here begins a dialectical definition, defining what love is not before declaring what it actually is. And so love that alters when circumstances change, or that ceases when the beloved is absent or changes, is not true love. And these lines reject the conditional or contingent love, and that love based on convenience and emotion and beauty, or other mutable qualities. The repetition of love is not love underscores the speaker's attempt to stabilize a concept constantly under threat from flux and mutability as well. With lines 5 to 8, now the love is defined. It is an ever-fixed mark, which is also seen as an unchanging guide, like a lighthouse or navigational star. It endures the tempests of passion, adversity, or time, and remains never shaken. And this metaphor of the nautical beacon suggests that love is constant amid chaos, like a moral or emotional compass. The lines are also significant as it positions love as both noble and mysterious. And the phrase wandering bark might also suggest the soul in search of direction, which echoes spiritual yearning. Moving on to lines 9 to 12. Here, time is personified as a reaper with a sickle, and beauty stabilized or symbolized by quote-unquote rosy lips and cheeks, and how that is doomed to fade. But love here is not time's fool. It doesn't age or decay with the body. And this marks a crucial distinction between physical desire, which is subject to time, and true love, which is eternal. And so the line, love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom. Here, true love does not change with the passing of time. It bears it out even to the edge of doom. And so it bears it out, which endures all the way and to the edge of doom, meaning the last judgment or death itself. And so the phrase intensifies the previous idea, where love persists through ephemerality and through mortality and through even to the apocalyptic finality. And we could also see a sense that true love endures beyond life and time and worldly endings. Moving on to lines 13 and 14. It's a self-referential move. The poet wagers his entire body of work and human experience on this definition. And this paradoxical claim, so the final two lines go, if this be error and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved. And so this paradoxical claim heightens the emotional and philosophical stakes of the poem. And so it's a true claim, but not just it's not just a lyrical musing, but a truth claim, to be exact. Moving on to Sonnet 117. Accuse me thus that I have scanted all, wherein I should your great deserts repay, forgot upon your dearest love to call, whereto all bonds do tie me day by day, that I have frequent been with unknown minds, and given to time your own dear purchased right, that I have hoisted sail to all the winds which should transport me farthest from your sight. Book both my willfulness and errors down, and on just prove, surmise, accumulate. Bring me within the level of your frown, but shoot not at me in your weakened hate. Since my appeal says I did strive to prove the constancy and virtue of your love. Now, in this first of a group, I guess it's going to be this one and the next several. It'll be sonnets of self-accusation and of attempts at explanation, and the poet lists the charges that can be made against him here in the sonnet, and then says he was merely testing the beloved's love. And so we get a little bit of action. With lines 1 to 4, the speaker invites accusation, setting the tone with, quote-unquote, accuse me thus, which is a rhetorical move that acknowledges guilt even as it attempts to control the terms of judgment. The phrase scant at all suggests he has withheld or failed to deliver what is due. The phrase your great deserts refers to the beloved's deserted reward, what they are owed by virtue of their worth and love. The speaker concedes forgetting to call upon the beloved's love, perhaps emotionally, sexually, or even in literal correspondence, despite the obligation created by all bonds, a phrase that evokes legal, social, and personal ties. The day by day emphasizes that this is not a one-time lapse, but a chronic failing. There's a tone of wearied remorse in this compact confession as well. With lines 5 and 8, now the speaker expands the accusation to more serious charges, consorting with unknown minds, suggesting betrayal, infidelity, or distraction. The line, given to time your own dear purchased right, is particularly loaded. The phrase time here could mean passing pleasures or distractions or even other lovers, something ephemeral and careless, and that he gave to time what was dear purchased by the beloved, and that implies a profound act of waste or betrayal. The phrase hoisted sail to all the winds, this is a metaphor for aimless, perhaps reckless wandering. It carries connotations of willful escape, of fleeing from the beloved, and there's an almost nautical self-exile here as he sails away not toward a purpose, but to ultimately escape. With lines 9 to 12, these lines shift tone again. The speaker formally submits to judgment, and he invites the beloved to book both his willfulness, his intentional wrongdoing, and errors, his mistakes. The line on just proof, surmise, accumulate, reflects legal and forensic language as he accepts the accumulative suspicion, even if some of it rests on conjecture, provided it's built on quote-unquote just proof. He accepts being brought, quote-unquote, within the level of your frown, a gorgeous metaphor, just a gorgeous one, within the level of your frown. That's just beautifully put. And so it's a metaphor evoking an emotional line of fire, but pleads not to be the target of quote-unquote awakening hate. And so it's kind of a militaristic metaphor, and this continues, where the frown becomes aim, hate, and becomes weapon. So the aim is frown, and the hate is the weapon. And so the phrase suggests he fears not just judgment, but the violent emotional rupture of hatred awakened. The final two couplets, or one couplet, delivers the poem's volta, and so a surprising paradoxical defense of would be how the volta is conveyed here. The speaker argues that all his apparent wrongdoings were actually a kind of test, an effort to prove the beloved's constancy and virtue. And this is a twisted form of reasoning, which suggests that by being faithless or distant, he was testing whether the beloved's love would ultimately endure. And so to read lines 13 and 14 again is, since my appeal says I did strive to prove the constancy and virtue of your love. And so it's a rhetorical sleight of hand. What looked like betrayal becomes, at least in his telling, an experimental devotion. And so this raises deep questions about the ethics of love, loyalty, and trust. And the speaker positions himself as both transgressor and tester, and a penitent and provocateur. And so that was Sonnet 117. Before we move on to Sonnet 118, I have one song for you guys. It's called Wuthering Heights by Kate Bush. And so we'll give this one a listen to, and we'll be right back.
It's
That was Wuthering Heights by Kate Bush. You know what? I will play one more song for you guys because why not? The song I will play for you right now is Laugh Till I Cry by the Front Bottoms. And so we'll be also right back after this.
I guess I just don't get your plan. Are you trying to smash my world up? I'm trying to understand. You say you know me, not truly who I am. You stress the modifier while I stress the adjective. Thinking about walking away the whole time, sleeping in the chair right next to me.
Just finished listening to The Front Bottoms, Laugh Till I Cry. And so we'll get right into Sonnet 118. Like as to make our appetites more keen, with eager compounds we our palate urge. As to prevent our maladies unseen, we sicken to shun sickness when we purge. Even so, being full of your never cloying sweetness, to bitter sauces did I frame my feeding, and sick of welfare found a kind of meatness, to be diseased ere that were that there was true needing. Thus policy and love to anticipate the ills that were not grew to faults assured, and brought to medicine a heathful state, which ranks of goodness would be ill be cured. But then I learn and find the lesson true, drugs poison him that so fell sick of you. And so here the poet uses analogies of eating and of purging to excuse his infidelities. And so it's also a very densely metaphorical meditation on love and desire and the paradoxes of prevention. Particularly how trying to avoid harm can ironically cause it. And so with lines 1 and 2, Shakespeare introduces a metaphor from the world of food and medicine. Just as we stimulate our appetite with sharp or eager substances, we artificially rouse desire. And the word urge implies a deliberate act of intensifying desire, suggesting the self-aware manipulation of feeling. With lines 3 and 4, this follows a medical analogy. People purge, perhaps with emetics or laxatives, common in medicine, before illness strikes, in order to prevent future disease, thus making themselves temporarily ill to stay healthy. And so this is paradoxical and ironic at the same time, where sickness is chosen as a form of health. The speaker introduces the idea of preventative damage, a self-inflicted wound made in fear of a future one. With lines 5 and 6, transitioning to love, the speaker says he was sated as in the word full, with the beloved's love, which was never cloying, never too much, never oversweet. Yet irrationally or strategically, he sought out quote-unquote bitter sauces to balance or counteract this sweetness. This feeding continues the food metaphor, but now becomes an emotional or erotic hunger. He deliberately introduces bitterness into the relationship, perhaps flirtations, absences, or cruelty, not because it was necessary, but because he thought it wise or desirable in moderation. With lines 7 and 8, the speaker confesses he became sick of welfare, which is tired of being well or uncomfortable, in the sheer protection of the relationship. Meetness, meaning suitability, refers to a misguided logic here, that being deceased, which means corrupted, unfaithful, or emotionally distanced, before a real threat appeared, made some kind of preemptive sense. And so this is a critique of overcautiousness, or a self-sabotage disguised as foresight. With lines 9 and 10, policy here refers to strategy or prudence. The speaker tries to anticipate hypothetical ills like betrayal, boredom, or emotional dependence by committing minor wrongs first. But this strategy becomes self-fulfilling as the imagined ills become faults assured, and preventive damage becomes actual harm. Lines 11 to 12. Here he applied a medicine to a state that was already healthy, thus turning wellness into an illness. The phrase rank of goodness suggests a superabundance of virtue or joy that he thought needed curing with some bitterness. And so this oxymoronic idea of curing goodness with ill reveals the tragic irrationality of his action. The final couplet. The speaker turns didactic. Also, he has learned a painful lesson. The very drugs he used to maintain or protect the relationship has poisoned him. And so the lover becomes a patient who has overdosed on the remedy. And the phrase, fell sick of you, is devastatingly ambiguous. It could mean both became ill because of you and sickened from too much love of you. And so that was Sonnet 118. Moving on to Sonnet 119. What potions have I drunk of siren tears, distilled from limbecks foul as hell within, applying fears to hopes and hopes to fear, still losing when I saw myself to win. What wretched errors hath my heart committed, whilst it hath thought itself so blessed never? How have mine eyes out of their spheres been fitted in the distraction of this madding fear? Oh, benefit of ill, now I find for true that better is by evil still made better. And ruined love, when it is built anew, grows fairer than at first, more strong, far greater. So I return rebuked to my content, and gain by ills thrice more than I have spent. And so, filled with self-disgust at having subjected himself to so many evils in the course of his infidelity, the poet nevertheless finds an excuse in discovering that his now reconstructed love is stronger than it was before. And so with lines 1 and 2, these lines open with a metaphor. The speaker imagines having consumed potions made from siren tears, a dangerous and seductive substance. And sirens are mythical creatures whose beautiful songs lure sailors to their deaths, so siren tears already suggest a toxic sweetness or a deadly allure. The term limbex refers to alchemical stills used in distillation, but these limbex are foul as hell within, suggesting the speaker's internal corruption, the self is transformed grief, or temptation to something poisonous. And with lines 3 and 4, it's a psychological portrait of inner confusion and emotional contradiction. The speaker misjudges his experience, his fears full hope, fuel hope, and his hopes become fearful. And this inversion results in constant disappointment. Even when he thinks he is winning, he is in fact losing. With lines 5 and 6, now the speaker indicts his own heart. The intensity of his self-delusion is stressed. He believes himself so blessed never, precisely when he was in the deepest error. The irony is piercing, and the illusion of joy masks a reality of ruin. Lines 7 and 8, the metaphor here escalates. His eyes are described as being dislocated from their spheres, and the phrase madding fever is potent, as love here is likened to an illness, a kind of delirium that destroys perception. With lines 9 and 10, here we're presented with the Volta. It's a redemptive paradox, where the speaker now claims that evil has yielded unexpected benefit. The phrasing benefit of ill is startling as it frames suffering as a teacher or purifier. And the line, better is by evil still made better, echoes a kind of alchemical transmutation, where through exposure to ruin, something even greater emerges. And it's line 11 and 12, the sonnet kind of is seen to resolve its place, where love, once ruined but later built anew, becomes even more beautiful and resilient. And the final couplet solidifies the moral, as the speaker has been rebuked by his errors, but this correction leads him back to content, a word that implies both emotional peace and romantic fulfillment. And in a final paradox, he claims a profit from his suffering. He gains thrice more than what he lost. And the economic metaphor underscores the idea that emotional affliction, far from being wasteful, has ultimately enriched him. So moving on to Sonnet 120. That you were once unkind befriends me now, and for that sorrow which I then did feel, needs must I under my transgression bow, unless my nerves were brass or hammered steel. For if you were by my unkind shaken, as I by yours, you've passed a hell of time, and I, a tyrant, have no leisure taken to weigh how once I suffered in your crime. Oh, that our night of woe might have remembered my deepest sense how hard true sorrow hits, and soon to you as you to me then tendered the humble salve which wounded bosoms fits, but that your trespass now becomes a fee, mine ransom yours, and yours must ransom me. And so in this sonnet about his unkindness to the beloved, the poet confronts himself with the memory of the time the beloved was unkind to him. And so with lines 1-4, the speaker opens with a paradox. The beloved's past unkindness now, quote-unquote, befriends him. But now we're left with the question of why. And the answer is because it offers a moral justification, or perhaps emotional precedent, for his own wrongdoing. The sorrow he felt back then teaches him humility now that he has committed a wrong, and he must bow to that guilt and accept his failings, unless he were utterly insensate, or which implies that he still retains human feeling and conscience. Lines 5 and 8, here he imagines the beloved having felt the same anguish he once did. And if that's true, then the beloved has endured a hell of time, which is a phrase suggesting not only prolonged suffering, but also punishment. The speaker condemns himself as a tyrant for not reflecting on that suffering earlier. He has been too remorseless, too absorbed in himself to weigh the symmetry of pain. With lines 9-12, let me try and read line 9-12 because it's really good. Oh, that our night of woe never might have remembered my deepest sense how hard true sorrow hits, and soon to you as you to me then tendered the humble salve which wounded bosom fits. Now, the night of woe likely refers to a monument of confrontation, separation, or recognition of mutual hurt. The speaker wishes he had remembered, felt fully the depth of true sorrow in that moment, so that he could have immediately extended the same comfort and forgiveness his beloved once offered him. The word tendered suggests both an offering and a gentleness, an echo of the tenderness missing from the speaker's past actions. Here now we are on to the final couplet. But that your trespass now becomes a fee, mine ransoms yours, and yours must ransom me. Now, this final two lines enacts a legal or financial metaphor. The beloved's former quote-unquote trespass wrongdoing is now a quote-unquote fee, a price paid or transaction that enables moral reciprocity. And so the speaker's wrong now redeems the beloved's past crime, and vice versa. And there's symmetry here, where love in this context becomes an economy of sin and forgiveness, a system where emotional depths are exchanged and not erased. And so I guess the bigger picture here that we can kind of leave off of is forgiveness is not about absolution, but about balance. And so each must pay, and each must pardon. And so that was Sonnet 120, and we have come to the end of our show today. We went through a deep reading of Sonnets 115 to 120, and so that was that. But other than that, nothing really much is going on. We are going to continue on next episode with Sonnets 121 onwards. Again, if you guys have any themes or content that you guys want me to cover and go over, I'd be more than happy to do so. So just please let me know. You can contact me through my number, 604-512-0020, 604-512-0020, or my email, leejess2002@gmail.com. And so I'm more than happy to, you know, interact with you guys or just do whatever you guys want me to do in regards to literature or music. You could also contact me through my Instagram page. It's j.essl. And so I'll be open to any suggestions or any feedback from whatever I do. And that is the end. I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your week. I will be back again on Wednesday at 11. And so have yourselves a beautiful, healthy week. And I will be back next week. Thank you all. Bye-bye.